Hello and welcome to the Eat PhD Team podcast, the podcast here to help you with your relationship with food and body by giving you evidence-based techniques to support yourself with a sprinkling of feminism, a dash of dismantling diet culture and a side of vulnerability as we share our own messy lives with you. I'm Emilia, a registered nutritionist and PhD with the sole purpose of making your life happier and healthier. If you love it, please do go wild and share it. And if you're ready for support with our coaching, details are in the show notes. Hello and welcome to episode number 293 of the Eat PhD Team podcast with myself and Steph. Hi Steph, how are you?
I am very well, thank you. How are you?
Great, I'm great, thank you. And Anna, how are you?
Good, thank you. All good.
Great. Gosh, what a positive bunch we are today.
It feels like I've been like not on the podcast for so long.
Yeah.
I think you missed one, didn't you?
Yeah, so it was like before Christmas. I was supposed to be in January and obviously wasn't because I was ill. And then, yeah, it ends up like, yeah, it just feels like it's been forever. So well, I'll be very rusty. I'll admit that now. So yeah, don't judge me.
The pressure is on. I think I've got olives in my tea. I'm going through a phase of just really loving olives. So whenever I've got a wee gap between calls or podcasts or whatever, I'm like, really sneaky olive. And Lidl do like all different types of olives, like garlic stuffed ones, feta stuffed ones. Oh my god, I'm just obsessed. And so I've just realized I've got some what I feel like is red pepper in my teeth, so I also apologize in advance, especially if anyone actually watches this. It's like if I'm not talking and you look at me, I've just got my tongue down my what's it called, chin. It's a real good look. Guys, I've got news.
Tell us.
It's not a baby, it's something else. I've started tracking again, not my calories.
You know what? I noticed it the other day when we did the mentoring pod and I was like,
what is this repulsive thing? No, well, I've started tracking my health things again, stats again. I got Tom, who is my, he does my training, and he was like, I'd quite like it because I like to do like CrossFit sessions like once a week, and I'll run once a week and then I'll do my three training sessions whatever. I'm mindful of pushing myself too hard, realistically. not gonna happen. But Tom was like, I'd quite like it, just like if you could keep track of your heart rate, that would be great. And my Fitbit is long since gone from back in the day. And so he was like, oh, a lot of the girls that I work with look quite like this Garmin. And I was like, oh, I'm not really, never thought I'd be a Garmin person because they're for like, you know, serious.
But you're a runner.
I know. Well, my recent runs, I've had to stop. There's a wee shop 15 minutes into my run, and twice I've had to stop and buy a chocolate flapjack because I feel like I'm going to pass out on my half an hour run. So that's how good a runner I am at the moment. I think it's blood volume, but I'm obviously it's cured by chocolate flapjacks, like the good cheap chocolate flapjacks, you know. The ones that I mean. So I started tracking. I got a refurbished Garmin, you know. I was like, I'm not going to spend loads of money on an activity tracker, come on. So I got a refurbished one from Amazon and it's great, and it's not really ugly. I mean, it's not the most attractive thing in the world, but it's not like hideous.
It's like a Ben sorry, you know, the Ben 10 Ben 10 watches that kids have.
Okay, wait, because I don't know Ben 10 watch.
Sorry.
Oh my god.
I always say at Christmas, like, take off that Ben 10 watch at that Christmas do. Like, come on, you don't need to track your activity. You're a superhero.
It's like that. Okay, I promise not to wear it at any social events.
That was very judgmental. I think it looks lovely.
That's done now.
Yeah,
all right. Now. Well, I got it because I want to check on my heart rate and also my sleep, because I'm to say I'm exhausted at the moment. Like, I'm trying to not complain, but I am very tired. So I'm just keep it maps your like stress, your body battery, things like this. And I'm like, okay, this is a good healthy thing for me to do. It won't let me turn off calories, which I don't like to have there. I don't feel any pull to look at them, but they're there. If you swipe through to your data, they're there, like on top screen, which I feel like is a flaw. I feel like any of these watches, you should be able to turn off any ones that you want, because why is a calorie a mandatory thing? Maybe for runners and stuff who wear garments, I don't really know. But if anyone sees me tracking, that's why. I'm not like seeking control as I lose control of my body in this time or anything like that. I literally am just being mindful of my heart rate and my sleep, and that's it. So I just like to put that disclaimer out there. I've not regressed in my relationship with food.
I monitor my steps though, like only recently, because I'm like, oh, I'm sick. I think it's because of the weather. I'm a bit like a bit slow and still at the minute. I think, and I use it on my Apple Health, so it's not as accurate because I don't always hold my phone. But I think it can be really helpful for whatever you need it to do. So for me, I'm like, I need to probably move my body a bit more. So.
I think step counts are good, and I think too, I work with a lot of people who like are scared to take the tracker off because they're like, what if I don't do any steps? And it's like, if you have been someone that's done 20,000 steps every single day and track them, the chance of you going to 2,000 steps overnight is slim to none. That being said, I don't know about you guys, but like I hadn't tracked my steps for years, apart from in lockdown when I came back from somewhere and I had to do 10 days in the house, and I remember doing my driveway 5K. That was the last time I tracked my steps. And actually, I thought I did only about 4,000 a day, but actually it was more, so I was quite grateful. But like I was way off in my estimations. And I think people think once you've tracked your food, once you've tracked your steps, you just know. But if it's been long enough, like a really long time, apparently you don't really. It actually can be quite inaccurate. This is not us telling you to go out and track if you don't track, but you know, open to all scenarios. Okay, let's get started on the questions. Steph, do you want to go first?
How to manage comments about your body when you aren't a confrontational person or don't want to get into a back and forth. I guess I mean how to manage your feelings around this so you don't immediately jump into a fasting or calorie restricted diet.
Obviously, we're three very confrontational people, so this is hard for us to understand. Look, I think there's a couple of things here. One is someone's made a comment on your body and you feel the urge to jump into fasting or calorie restriction. And that's something to get curious about, in that, why is someone else's opinion more important than yours? Why is their opinion of your body, which is skewed in their own lens and by so many different factors, why do you rate what they've said enough to change your entire healthy behaviors? For someone that I don't know who, you know, maybe this has happened and I don't know how close this person is to you, but it may not even be someone that is close to you, and you're giving them autonomy over your body. Like, you are worth far more than someone else's opinion of your body. And you know, part of this work is going to hopefully get you to the place that a lot of people who work with us get to, which is, my body is worthy of care and respect, and that is more important than the perception of someone else. Like, don't allow someone else to have that power. It's easier said than done, but you're giving away your power, which I feel like is from some sort of awful American secret type of vibe book, but that's not what I mean. Okay.
I was gonna say, it was like you don't have to be confrontational to speak about something that matters, because I'm not confrontational, but if something matters to me, I'll just think like, well, this matters, and I want to maybe say something, whether it is a boundary or just vocalizing it. And it wasn't until I learned about emotional rest. Apparently, vocalizing your needs is a way to restore emotional stress. And I was like, oh, that makes a bit of sense, actually. Kind of, you know, speaking up a bit
What you
more.
mean, rather than sitting with those uncomfortable feelings though?
I know. Mind
I've
blown.
never heard it framed that way, but it's
Made
genius
sense,
framing.
no?
It's absolute genius framing. Like, as someone who may well stew sometimes on things rather than say them, it's pretty exhausting.
Yeah, it is. I spiral and I'm like, oh, if I just said something, I might start to spiral.
But no, we're not confrontational people. Okay, Anna, question.
How much vitamin D should you take a day, and do you have any preferred brands?
So the actual, I'm just going to double check the BDA recommendations for vitamin D, because they say 10 micrograms of vitamin D. I often will err upwards of that. Possibly like, and you can get some supplements that are like 25. And you will see some people at sometimes the units are international units and sometimes they're micrograms. So just be mindful that you're not going to take. So sometimes we might say 1,000 international units. Don't go and try and take 1,000 micrograms, for example. Otherwise, like you, because you can technically overdose on vitamin D, technically, and potentially could lead to things like calcification and stuff. So we don't want to take massively excess. But I, from the research that I'm aware of, especially in the UK in winter months, like 10 micrograms is the RDA, which is sufficient for 95% of people on average, but that's not everyone. So if I'm being BDA aligned, it would be 10 micrograms. I tend to re recommend slightly more than that, and I recommend taking it all year round, especially because you can only get vitamin D from the sun in the UK between April and October. But if you wear sunscreen and you wear clothes, which hopefully you do both of those things, although you do you, then that will dampen the amount of vitamin D that you can convert from sunlight.
I take it in a spray form.
I was
I don't
gonna
know.
say, have you tried the spray? Yeah.
Yeah, under the charm, jobby.
I'm
Getting
sorry, but that visual was too much for me. Under the tongue, jobby. If you live in Scotland, that is the worst visual.
Why? I want to know why.
Do you know what jobby is, though?
Yeah, but I want you to explain.
No.
No.
I've still got a little bit of nausea, and I don't need a visual of poo under
Well,
your tongue.
now I know where your head lives, so
As if you didn't know before.
no. But I don't know what the brand is that I use though. It's like a green one. That's all I know, and it's a spray.
Just use my protein. Do it when I order my whey.
Same.
And it's super affordable. And what I like about vitamin D, you can just take it like you can take your weekly dose, can't you? Your
You
dose
can.
for the week in one. And then it's one less thing to think about if you're someone that does struggle with daily stuff, which is me.
Do it daily, so you can take it once a week. Oh,
You can take like a super dose. I don't mean super as in excessive, I just mean like a week's dose. One.
So you can have your seven sprays down.
The trouble with that is I'll forget if I have taken a weekly dose, and then I'll end up taking it. I'll be overdosing, you know. So
I was going to say, you do something that you do weekly, like on bin day. I don't know.
you.
I don't do the bins, so wouldn't know.
Also, I would say I would always recommend getting a blood test from your doctor before you start supplementing with things, just to see where you're at with things. Because vitamin D is kind of one that we should probably all be supplementing with, but it's useful to know where your deficiencies are before you start supplementing with various different things. It's me. How to create boundaries around comments that instantly create sadness? So this, for context, this person is pregnant. For example, you don't look pregnant, you just look chubby. My reaction here was not only shock, but sadness. I reflected after I'd stopped crying, hormone central, but any in-the-moment strategies. I was like, what a bell end, but then I realised that's not an in-the-moment strategy. That was just an immediate reaction from me. And then I was like, they're not a bell end, they just have a bell end. That was a bellend thing to say. I'll stop saying bellend
The
now.
visual of that. To be honest, I will let Anna answer this one because I've forgotten the question. All I think of is bellend, so sorry.
You want me to repeat it, or do you know it, Anna?
Well, I mean, keen to hear what you guys think, but I would treat it in the same way that I would treat any other feeling. in taking that step back, noticing, and obviously they've been able to name the feeling as sadness. Great. That for me, that might be in the moment, compassionate touch, or having a reminder to yourself that you can repeat internally in sod the bell and ignore them. Whatever that might be that can help just soothe you. And then I would say, taking some time later to kind of explore, okay, well, what came up for me? Is it because they just commented on my body? Is it because there's something around chubby that brings up some stuff for me? And working through that, but once that initial emotional response has calmed down.
We were talking earlier, I think it wasn't on the podcast anyway, about like the unsolicited comments around bodies when you're pregnant. It's something like I haven't experienced this for a very, very, very long time, and immediately I started to experience it myself, and I was like, this is a whole new world of the it's like your body becomes public property, and a lot of time they're well-meaning, you know, like comments like, oh, but your bump still looks small, or you don't look pregnant, or they can be also unwell meaning, like this comment. And it's wild that we haven't got to this place here where we're getting to with people who aren't pregnant, of we know now that ideally we don't comment on people's bodies. And I feel like pregnancy is like a different world. I don't know if boundaries is the right thing here. I wonder if you're looking for something that's quite logical to try and cope with what is effectively like an emotional response, which is like, don't beat yourself up for having an emotional response to a comment like that. I think what you said, Anna, about going back and reflecting on it later is such a good idea. But if that person's in your life, then yeah, and on the whole with pregnancy, you might want to think about, okay, what are my boundaries around people commenting on my bodies, and how am I going to navigate that moving forward? Like, if someone says something to me, do I want to have a statement that I'm like, well, actually, I don't allow comments about my body whilst I'm pregnant, but thank you so much for your unsolicited opinion, or something like that. And if you have the pregnancy tolerance or intolerance, and I feel like that one will be quite an easy one for you to do, but I would just wonder if you're looking to kind of, you're trying to logic your way out of it rather than just kind of go, that was a really crappy thing that they said and it upset me. This is why it upset me. And I'm going to name it and I'm going to move on from it. And rather than like necessarily try and, yeah, logic my way out or think my way out of it. Steph.
How do you manage your eating during times of crisis when all your usual coping mechanisms escape you and you're feeling completely overwhelmed?
We don't have times of crisis, babe. We don't have those things. I'm good, no.
I think just being able to, well, meet yourself with compassion and say, yeah, do you know what? Like, it's okay if these new tools that I'm working to develop, when I'm feeling completely overwhelmed, just go out of my head, like, hi, human, that's what happens. And I think if your first thing can be, okay, I'm feeling overwhelmed, I need to create some space, because it's in that space that then you can choose how you respond. And I mean, if that for me is just doing a couple of deep breaths. And if you can, if I would be working that into the day regardless, just to help general feelings of stress. But then it's going to feel a bit more automatic when those feelings do build up, that that can be my go-to. And then I might be able to think about the coping mechanisms.
I was going to say as well, probably I think when we think of crisis and like being in that emotional state, we think about emotional tools, whereas I sometimes think, right, what's the physical tools that I can put in place, like leaning onto a bit of structure and routine. Maybe it's like, right, I'm going to have that breakfast. I'm not going to give myself too many options. I'm just going to make sure that's what I'm having, you know, tomorrow morning, and have a bit of a beat in the day, instead of like what you said earlier, Amelia, about sort of like outthinking your emotions and overcomplicating it and analysing it. And yes, of course, you want to support that, but sometimes a good old-fashioned moving my body, can, and just that the external habits that we obviously don't just do at ETPHD, but they are also great in sort of these situations. So leaning back onto a little bit of routine in terms of nutrition, I think can be just something that we just don't really think about, but it's like so helpful.
Yeah, I totally agree. Like my two go-tos when I'm in crisis are eating enough, eating regularly, and giving myself a break. And I don't mean a physical break, I mean show myself some compassion. If and for me that means that if I emotionally eat, or like I think I don't know what podcast I said this was, but Anna and I sent Anna a picture the other day of just like a mountain of Malteser wrappers, like Malteser Christmas ones on the sofa. And I was like, we don't eat our feelings at ETPHD because I mean, a mountain, like obviously I just had some chocolate, but for me it's like, okay, well that's not a time of crisis, but it's a miniature version of what I'm trying to say. I still ate my meals like regular and still made sure, and I knew that I was probably prone to that because I'm snacky, so I'm making my meals bigger. And it's, I honestly just think eating regularly and saying to yourself, oh, it's fine. Like, it's fine. This happens sometimes. It's fine. Like, move on, is underrated. Anna.
So this is someone that's new working with me, and she said, I struggle to feel connected to myself most of the time. When I was growing up, my mum used to go out of her way to excessively praise all of her friends, children, my cousin, my friends, whilst talking about them to me. Through my counselling training, I've realised that as a result of this, I would imitate these other children in an effort to get some praise from my mum, which I never did. I have carried this tendency into adulthood, and whilst I catch myself doing it now, I struggle to allow myself to be myself because I don't really truly know who that is. Any advice on getting to know myself better?
The first thing that comes to mind is like experimenting a bit. I'm trying to think of like in context of a week, like maybe you go to, just go with me on this, like a pottery class, and you might come back from it and you're like, God, that was so boring, or oh, that was all right. I think you don't know until you try. So I think just maybe look at this time and commit to this. Maybe you say to yourself, like, this spring, I'm gonna commit to just doing like solo time, things for myself. Think like referring back to like how I feel after I do things, especially if you're someone that often takes other people's opinions and values on board. So doing things solo, but also when you're doing these things, you might meet other people and meet people that are maybe similar to you or bring out a different personality trait in you. And also like clinging on to people that you feel yourself around. I know you're saying you don't know what that feels like at the minute, but I think we can all relate to spending time with people and then afterwards kind of reflecting on the things that we've said and going, oh God, I sounded stupid then or whatever. And then there's some friends that you just don't even think about like that. And I'm sure there's people in your life that they may be, you know, just very accepting. I just think spend more time with people that are very open-minded. I think that's obviously quite helpful. But yeah, experiment. That was my point, wasn't it? Experiment.
I like that. I think too, I wrote an email today for my email list tomorrow, Friday, on like the importance of having hobbies that are not there to develop yourself in some way, and they're not there with an end goal, but they're there just because they bring fun into that moment, and recognizing them that how important that is to just have fun in the moment, because this is your life and not everything has to have a be a means to an end. And I wonder with this side of things too, can you release the pressure of I'm doing these things so that I find out who I am, so that I'm in this self-developed place. I naturally just go, I'm doing this thing because it looks absolutely wild and I've wanted to try it for ages, or I'm doing this thing because I saw TikTok on it and it looked really fun, so I want to go and try it, or whatever it is, but release the pressure of it having to have some sort of like resolution at the end of it, or like, yeah, like it's not a means to an end, it's just fun. Because when you figure out who you are, the idea is that you can just be, like, you're not trying to achieve or trying to hustle or, you know, try and get to that end point. It's just like you're okay with who you are in that moment. So try and focus your activities, whether they be hobbies or reading or making new friends, whatever it is, different types of exercise, whatever it is, can you do it just for that moment rather than the end point?
Didn't tell you guys, do you know what one of my Christmas presents was from my mum? Zip wire experience in Wales. It's like the biggest zip wire in the world.
I'm
like,
so jealous.
Do you know me?
That will be awesome.
I'm definitely going to pee my pants a bit though.
It's the biggest one in Europe, right? Or something like that.
Yeah.
Your mom's great.
Yeah.
Sorry, I know it's very random for you, but I'm all good for her pushing you out your comfort zone.
I know. Apparently, I won't step out of it enough. So, here, have a push.
Actually, are you? Is she going with you?
No, of course not.
Literally, just you.
Just me. She's like, oh, well, someone has to look after the dog, don't they? Cheers, cheers.
So is she just going to like send you off? Bye, have a lovely time on the zip wire.
Who knows? Who knows? I was like, oh, well, I can make a weekend of it. I'll do Snowdon again or something.
Yeah, well, I'll come. I wouldn't leave that.
Yeah. Oh, you'll come and see.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, do
well,
it with me.
Unfortunately, for the next year or so, I don't think I'll be allowed on the zip wire. So sorry. Because I would actually like to do it, but I don't think it's safe for me to do it right now.
I did one in Montenegro, and I am someone that is scared of heights, but I don't know what possessed me to be like, sure, I'll do that. And it was actually lovely. And it was, I'm trying not to admit myself here, so I'm actually realizing what I'm saying. So I'm going to stop myself now with just saying it was lovely, full stop. But it was.
Okay. Well, we'll see in a couple of months' time.
Yeah, anyway, I hope they've got some sort of like GoPro video thing where they can film your face.
I really hope they do. It'll just be me screaming.
Yeah, I'll pay for that. You just invoice me over. Tell me how much it costs and I'll pay for that. I feel like it would bring me a lot of joy. Okay, I think it's me. Ways out of ADHD paralysis.
I would. This probably sounds a bit obvious, but sometimes the most simple things are probably the most effective. Moving your body. It doesn't have to be like going for a run or anything like that, or going to the gym, but just even just stepping outside, getting out of space, like out of the space you're in, or stretching, just something physical, I think always goes a long way. And I've been doing this with, I think who I've done it with, not that that matters, but focusing on like little wins. So sometimes with ADHD, you've got a bit more of like an interest-based like nervous system, if you want to call it that. And so you respond quite well to like praise, you respond well to like positive vibes. And maybe what you might need in this moment is just to create a bit of like, oh, that was a bit of a win. So even if it's just like, right, I've got a pile of pants that I need to put in the drawer and are still there, and I know that if I just do it, I will feel better. Like something that's really accessible and achievable, but it is a small win. And then what will happen is you probably will build a bit of momentum, and then that can help as well. So I would focus on moving or like small wins or both, and that can just kind of break it a little bit. That's where I'd start.
Is there an association with like nervous system like dysregulation and ADHD paralysis? Does it usually come with like dysregulation? Does it usually come with like hypo or hyperarousal, or is it just kind of everyone's different? Do you know?
I think it more or less, I think everyone is different. I think it's very, what I've sort of looked into, you can get into a freeze state quite easily. So breaking that, I talk about like exercise inertia can be a thing as well. Like just even though you know something will be good for you, that thought isn't good enough. So, oh, another thing I read the other day actually, again, I've not tried it, not done it with a client, so I don't know if it's any good, but sometimes switching tasks can be quite hard as well. But if you have something continuous in the background, so let's say you've got some music on, you're doing like a work block, but then you've got to do something that's a bit more demanding and you've got to kind of shift gears a little bit, or maybe you've got to go out the house. But if you continue to listen to like the same thing, apparently, I don't know if this actually works or not, but there's a bit of reading into it, that can be really helpful, like getting into like the next activity, because that's, you know, that task initiation, like that's quite difficult for most people with ADHD. So I'm gonna try that and experiment that. But
Interesting.
yeah, so
I was speaking to
yeah.
someone today, a coach that I work with, about, she has ADHD and trying sometime in a coffee shop for background noise and having that consistent background noise and to see how that impacts, like, I guess task initiation, but also just like her focus and if having that just that constant background stimulation, but like low grade is actually helpful. Like I guess it's similar-ish to things like brown noise or whatever. But a different version of it. Interesting.
I remember doing as well, sorry, I was gonna say like different music, you can get into a proper rabbit hole with this, but like classical music apparently has got a lot of effect on helping you with sort of like focusing. So there's obviously different musics will probably, different musics, that wasn't good English, different type of music will probably, you know, respond, you'll respond differently. But classical music apparently is very good for that. And I think ESG told me about that as well. I'm sure we've spoken about that before. But anyway, yeah.
Interesting. I'm going to kind of tie the second question into this because it's on the same wavelength. For people with ADHD, tips for working through RSD and burnout, please.
RSD, so that's rejection sensitivity dysphoria, and it's absolutely wild that this isn't part of the diagnostic criteria yet. One of my, sorry, I will bring myself back to the point, but just because she knows, she listens to this podcast, but she, when she was getting diagnosed with ADHD, she didn't know anything about RSD, and so that's basically like intense feelings of, for example, if you perceive something as criticism, or if you get any sort of rejection, relationship, work related, da da da, like the feeling is like really intense. And she always got a bit triggered by certain comments by like her parents and friends and stuff. And she was like, it really, like, it completely consumes me. And then I was like, oh, have you ever like explored RSD? And then I remember that week, I think the following week, she did a bit of a rabbit hole into it and just learned obviously a lot more about it. And she said the fact of like reading about RSD in itself and understanding it can be so helpful. And obviously that's something that we all know. Understanding something, you're able to actually be a bit more compassionate with yourself. So I would definitely look into that a little bit more. But to help with RSD, because there's kind of two parts to that with burnout, which yeah, they do link a little bit. But I would say keeping, like you might have a card from a friend that says something really nice about you, or maybe just collecting like positive feedback about you. Because genuinely, when you're in that state of mind, it's so hard to kind of get out of it. But reading something that's positive about you, just to kind of rationalize these thoughts that are happening that might not be true as well, because it's also perceived like criticism. And then I would also, you know, speaking with someone you trust is obviously something great to do. I always Trav, who's my toolbox, but just like speaking out loud, like from my own experience, is just, it's obviously really helpful. And then we talk about the emotional toolbox, and I think part of that is like the self-soothing toolbox. So I would say something like sensory restorers, whether it's like a hot shower, hot bath, or like holding a hot drink, or like cold flat, like cold water on your face, just give you a bit more like external stimuli to just kind of get you out of it. So that's more RSD related for like practical tools. But with burnout, it's so, I think ADHD and burnout is like a continuous thing that you really have to monitor. Because it kind of creeps up on you without you realizing. So we were talking about this before the podcast about sort of sequences and steps. Anna spoke about things that she's learning about, and it's so important that we don't just practice those tools in the moment, that we continuously start to do these things daily, and that we don't just wait for extreme burnout or extreme sadness or whatever to then implement a tool. Like, you know, like we said, eating regularly, that could be a tool. Moving your body, that's a tool that we want to look at every day. So that's probably not, you know, specific for burnout, but obviously everything will sort of connect. So it's just also working out your path where you notice where you might know that you're going to get burnt out. Like, I know after a weekend of socializing, I need to be really careful with my time after that. So I'll take some, you know, make some things happen where I'm just a little bit more like solo, and things like that. So just knowing yourself, obviously.
This sort of ties into this, but kind of not really, but one of the best gifts I ever got was my best friend made me a jar, and I still have it, and I've used it as a gift to other people, well, a person, a jar, and inside of it is just like loads of small pieces of folded over card, and it's just like all the reasons why I love you. And it's just, it's so nice, and I still have it somewhere. I was looking, I thought it was there, I don't know. And it will be like some trivial stuff, some really nice stuff, and she's like my oldest best friend, so she knows me really well. And it's, that ties into that kind of thing of like maybe a card from your friend or something like that. Maybe you could do it for yourself, or maybe like you could do it with a friend and say, oh, like, I heard this really cool gift, like, we should all in our group of friends or in our relationship do this for each other. It's just a nice thoughtful thing to do. And then my friend gave me that 4 years ago or something, and I still have it. And sometimes I'm like, what did she say about me this time?
Yeah.
I was just going to say, Steph, it's funny with what you were saying with the burnout side of things, because I was doing something on like pain energy cycle with like chronic pain, and how like you were saying, actually planning in for, this would be more in relation to flare-ups, but actually, like, if you know that you're in a situation that is going to be more taxing, potentially lead to burnout, like actually scheduling those days into your diary, and then kind of thinking, okay, look, I'm going to have 2 days where like it's bare minimum because I'm burnt out, and then the next 2 days might be like, okay, what does like the middle ground look like, and then 3 days where I'm back to my optimal state again. So that, because often, like, whether it's ADHD burnout or not, like, because we live in hustle culture, like, there is those, well, I should be doing more, I'm not being productive enough, guilt, shame, everything else, and actually, oh no, if I've planned for it, I'm okay, like, I'm doing what I can.
I think the worst thing about ADHD, in my opinion, is that you can't predict a lot of, like, when you're feeling exhausted. Like, you might go through a week where you're like, God, really good week this week. And then you're like, right, making loads of plans. You've got loads of things going on and you're really excited. And then a day out of nowhere, and maybe you haven't socialized, or maybe you haven't, you know, overexhausted yourself at the gym, you just feel a little bit like slow, or just, you know, you're not as on it as what you'd like to be. And it just takes you out. And it's just so hard to kind of come out of that a little bit and then plan for it. But I just think with people I work with where they can resonate with that and just go through those periods of just up and down, that you, it's almost like you really have to be, I know we use the word boundaries quite a lot, but like, you have to be very intentional with your time. And that's the same with working. Like, you know, obviously you can get distracted quite easily. So when you're working, like, don't have your phone near you, just be really intentional with that. And just being quite on it with that to help, like, set yourself up well. But yeah, I think it's just quite hard when you just don't know when it's going to happen. That's
the
just
unpredictability of it.
Okay. Steph, question.
Me. Right, where is it? Okay. Can you achieve sufficient protein intake with a vegetarian diet?
Yes. The irony, or the annoying part about having a vegetarian diet, if you're really looking to optimize protein, is that you probably should be aiming for on the higher end of optimal. So if we said, you know, like 1.6 grams-ish per kilogram body mass per day, generally, this might be a bit higher if you are perimenopausal or postmenopausal. It might be a little bit lower if you're in a larger body. But on the whole, like if we use that as a bit of a reference point, if you're vegetarian, I'd probably aim more towards, ideally, if you're really looking to optimize this, like 2 grams per kilogram body mass per day ish. Because vegetarian sources tend to be, on the whole, incomplete, not complete, not totally. So things like soy, for example, is a complete protein source. Dairy, proteins, complete protein source. Vegan, you're in a, it's a little bit more challenging. Again, you can have soy, but once you cut out dairy, it does become more challenging. And I don't know if, like, I don't know if any of you have ever tried to go vegan. I've had phases where I've not been quote unquote vegan, but I've definitely eaten like predominantly vegan type of foods and not had dairy for, or not been into dairy as much. It's definitely not the case now. But you know, I would get like an Alpro protein yogurt, which are, again, they're a lot better now, but like they were like, oh, this is the high protein version, and you still have to ha add whey protein to it, and which defeats the purpose of it in my opinion, because I like the taste of it and I like the consistency of it, and then you'd add whey protein to it, and then, or not whey, I mean I would add whey, you could add a vegan one, but then it's not the same, like it is more difficult, but you can do it. I mean, I think that I do it, I have a lot of clients who do it. I would aim for more, and I would aim predominantly for complete protein sources, like soy. So things like tofu or Linda McCartney sausages, like dairy, so Greek yogurt, eggs. Eggs are not dairy, but it's on the same sort of line. Yeah, and just I think take the pressure off of, like, someone asked me in one of my check-ins this week about having like complete protein sources, and you know, the protein source she was using was not a complete protein source, it was fine. She was like, how can I pair it and things like that. And I think if you really, really want to get into that, then you can. And you know, when people start with us, we'll always give examples of pairing incomplete protein sources together, just to, so you can understand what that might look like. But it's very, it's not necessarily like a, if you're getting a variety of protein sources, vegetarian protein sources, you're probably going to be getting all of your essential amino acids on the whole throughout the day if you're having variety. If you're someone who eats very similar meals a lot of the time and you're vegetarian, or if you're vegan, then I would be a little bit more mindful of making sure that you're having more and making sure that you, or at least are looking into, how can I pair, you know, my beans and my pulses and my rice and my grains, how, what pairings would work well for those types of foods on the whole, but don't get lost in it. Anna.
Best exercises for glutes if you can't do anything with weight pressing on stomach for context due to bladder pain issues.
I'm thinking of all the glute exercises I can do. You could still do, I was just thinking, obviously, can't have it with the weight on, but for a hip thrust, you could still do a single leg hip thrust with no weight, just to, yeah. Donkey kicks,
Like all
crunch.
the basic ones, like hinge patterns, squat patterns, lateral squats, abduction. So things like Cossack squats plus like abduction machine or abduction cables. Apart from like you said, Steph, like you could put some alternatives for hip thrusts in there, but apart from that, everything should be relatively similar, right?
Yeah, lunges as well. Like, did you say lunges? You
I
did.
said squat patterns, so yeah, like yeah, that
Like
might.
a reverse lunge, like taking a bigger step back. Yeah.
Front foot elevated, rear foot elevated. Yeah, obviously split squat, like Bulgarian split squats forever. I know they're very effective.
I'm quite happily programmed in for every client, and then when it comes to my own training, I'm like, nope, we'll move those.
Why are they so gross? Why?
I think they're one of the ones that, even though like you know that you're getting stronger and you can see progress in like oh, I can do it with this weight now, they still feel like absolute, like they're just horrific every time. So yeah,
But
funny.
I think part of what makes them so horrific is that they're hard anyway, but then you know you have to do the other leg. So it's like you know it's hard, but like with squats, right? You know they're grim, but you're just doing a set. But I did notice this when I was doing B stance squats for a while, because I don't really squat. I'll do like goblets or leg press, but I don't tend to do full squats. And I was doing B stance ones and I was like, Christ, I've got to do this on the other leg. Like, ugh. So I feel like it's that. I think it's the bilateral thing or the unilateral thing.
Think that is the case, yeah.
Okay, last question. How would you describe practicing radical acceptance? Well, how I'd describe it, like it is what it
I
is.
was gonna,
That's what it
that is what I was thinking. I was like, it is what it is. And yeah,
in lame,
that's
like
that.
in layman's term, like in layman's terms, in this, and that's how we like to describe things. It's basically making an effort to just acknowledge, accept, honor certain situations and emotions that come up. And it's based on like the Buddhist principle that like pain, it's that saying of like pain is inevitable, suffering is a choice, of like the pain is going to happen. And we use an example with with people that we work with about like, okay, it's raining. You can either put your umbrella up and go out in the rain, or you can complain about it being wet and be annoyed for your morning because you're getting wet on your way to work. Like, it's going to rain regardless. So it's like the pain comes from the rain, but the suffering comes from you being talking about it and moaning about it and being pissed off with it. That's a trivial example, but that is like, that's how I would describe it.
Just as you're talking, it was very like beautiful because I've just got these like raindrops on the dripping down. Like, Amelia's talking about radical acceptance. It was like a visual beauty just then. So thanks for
Oh, you're so welcome. You're so welcome.
that.
Okay, fab questions. Keep them coming. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thanks.
Thanks so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed it. And as always, if you did, please do feel free to like, share, subscribe, and review. And if you would like to chat to me, then you can find details of my Instagram in the show notes.